what triggered this bizarre behavior.
Journey into the cold heart of Northern Darkness with Nordic Crimes.
That case became like a scene from a horror movie.
A new true crime documentary series that chilled the bone.
The hunger for killing is increasing in the course of these homicides.
Listen on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Nordic Crimes is a part of the Acast family.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, and welcome back to 1 Minute Remaining. My name is Jack Lawrence, the host and creator of this show. Today is a first for OMR, as I sit down with a man by the name of Mark Newell. Mark is the brother of John Newell, the former husband of Karen Newell, who is currently incarcerated for his murder. Since I began this podcast back in September of 2022, I'd always stated that this is about giving incarcerated men and women the opportunity to share their stories, their side of what happened during the events which would lead to their incarceration. Now, of course, I've been asked many times in the past, what about the victims? And my answer has always been the same. I'm not out actively searching for these people or contacting them. And this is for a multitude of reasons, but the biggest one being is that having been through a traumatic event of potentially losing a loved one or being involved in some form of serious crime, it's undoubtedly painful and life-changing. And in most cases, we'll live with them forever. So having some random podcaster from Australia calling you to not only remind you of it, but also ask if you'd like to relive that experience is not something I personally wish to do. Also, if people involved in these cases hear about or see the show, they can choose to ignore it. If I call them, I'm throwing it in their face and telling them about it. They have no choice to avoid it. Although in saying that, I have always been of the mindset that should someone involved in a case we discuss reach out to me, I would very much welcome that. And that is exactly what happened a few weeks ago. Mr. Newell.
Yes, can you hear me?
I've got you, sir. How are you?
Tremendous.
I do apologize. I'm all right. I'm actually getting over food poisoning.
Oh, no. Boy, this has not been a good...
While sitting in Prison Pod HQ, I got an email notification. I'd received a message from a man by the name of Mark Newell. And the email read as follows. Jack, I hope this reaches you directly and you're doing well. My name is Mark Newell. If the last name sounds familiar to you, this is in relation to a three-part series of OMR this past late May to early June titled Hollywood to Hell, featuring Karen Newell. On the recommendation of some contacts, I recently listened to the inmate interviews from those episodes, and I was struck with both wonderment and entertainment. The amount of outright lies and fabricated stories, at points, made me laugh out loud. I do credit you with asking some penetrating queries and doing bona fide research. My question is, would you like to do a follow-up on this story from the family's point of view? Let's start from the very beginning, you know, how you remember your brother and him as a person.
John was a very interesting person. He was much more quiet than myself and my other brother. We share a birthday 4 years apart.
Oh, wow.
Growing up, he was a normal kid. He did all the normal kid things, participated in sports, was active in church, he had friends, and he did well in school, but he always gravitated towards things that required hands-on. And that is why when it came to graduating from high school, instead of going to college like the other two, he decided to go to trade school to get a degree in automotive engineering. And that is how he came to be working at a dealership in Orlando.
And did very well, as far as I can tell, in that job.
He was highly respected. All his coworkers really liked him, liked his handiwork. And he did well. He was in his zone. He was fulfilling his life with his passion.
Did you guys have a close relationship as brothers? You know, did you spend much time together?
My natural father died when I was in fourth grade. So John would have been in kindergarten, and my other brother was not even in school yet. So I became the sort of man of the house, if you want to say, for quite a while as we were growing up. But he was never a problem. He was very obedient. And again, he was quiet.
Yeah.
If he needed something to do, he could self-entertain himself. He'd find an old clock someplace and take it apart and put it back together. My mother remarried a widower who also had two kids when John was almost in high school. And I was almost out of high school. That was a good relationship. In the States, we call it a Brady Bunch. We had kids from both sides, but there was no problems there. So that's sort of, we weren't ships in the night, but we also didn't share the same passions. I was always out. I was doing lots of things and doing all the things that high schoolers do. And then I went off to college. Mm-hmm. And John was more reserved, more to himself and his close group of friends.
What was he like when it came to relationships? Like, was he sort of someone who fell in love very easily, very quickly, hard, wear his heart on his sleeve type situation?
That I can't really address in detail. He didn't have any heavy relationships in high school, nor did he in college. When he graduated from the tech school, he went back to our hometown where he met a young lady who happened to be a nurse in the Navy. She was stationed at the in Chicago, which isn't far away from our hometown. And they had a whirlwind romance. And they got married, and immediately after the wedding, he went down to be with her because she was reassigned from Chicago down to Orlando, and that's how he ended up in Orlando. Once there, she was put on a cruise. The Navy gets deployed, and on deployment, they sort of drifted apart. And when she came back, they got a divorce. It was amicable, but a divorce nonetheless. And I don't know if he had a lot of relationships after the divorce before the time that he met Karen.
Mark says that due to him being deployed to Korea with the military, he didn't have a great deal of regular contact with his brother and would find out about John and Karen's new relationship from their mother. He'd briefly mentioned that he had met someone new and he liked her very much and could see something potentially coming from it. The relationship was such a quick whirlwind that Mark would in fact meet Karen just twice, one of those times being at his brother's funeral. The first meeting definitely left a lasting impression on the family.
We only met her once. Again, right before we deployed to Korea, that summer after I saw him at Christmas, they drove up from Orlando to Wisconsin, where we lived, to attend a wedding, a cousin's wedding. And so this is the first time that we met her. The first impression was she came out of John's Camaro wearing a one-piece, very revealing black, I don't know what you call them, bodysuit or something like that. We thought it was a little bit inappropriate to meet the mother-in-law the first time wearing something of that sort. While she was there and we were getting ready to go to the wedding and stuff, she pretty much kept to herself. She always told John what to do and where to go and how to be. They were late for the wedding. They were late to the reception. They were at the reception for a little while, and then she complained about being ill. And so they left the reception in about not even an hour. The next day, we all went to a reunion, the extended family reunion up in northern Wisconsin. She stayed away from all the relatives. She went water skiing. And then later that day, we went to see my elderly grandma, who was in a nursing home nearby. And she refused to meet with her. We did, but she didn't. And then they left the next day. And that is the only time that we met her until the funeral itself.
Detectives would say that the motive for John's murder was money. More specifically, life insurance policies, for which John had many.
Before he got married, he had two life insurance policies. After he was married, they ended up with 13 of them. 11 of them had Karen's name on them. The large ones, the $500,000 one and the other one, were taken out after they got married. I was aware of his insurance because he came to visit our family, just him, not her, right before I deployed to Korea. I'm an Army officer, and our family went to Korea in 1993. He came for Christmas, and he and I got to talking, and he let it be known that Karen was pregnant, and he was overjoyed. And he and I went for a little walk to talk about things because I was a dad. He wasn't.
Yep.
He had some questions, and we talked about raising a family and other dad type things. And he just sort of off the cuff mentioned, or maybe I asked, about insurance, about taking care, because now that he's going to be a father, they're already married, he's in a job type that might lend itself to hazardous on the job hazards. I mean, working with automobiles and things like
that. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And so he thought it was prudent to get some insurance. And then he started listing off the insurance. And I said, wow, you, I said, you seem to be a little bit overinsured. And he said, no, that's what she wants. So that's what I want. And that's what we want for our kid.
Right. So he said that that's what Karen wants. She wants that sort of level of insurance.
Right. Because if anything were to happen to him. So they ended up with 13 life insurance policies, a mortgage policy, which if anything happens, the mortgage is paid off on their house. They had riders on their automobile insurance in case something happened, the cars would be paid off. And they also went and pre-bought cemetery plots at a local cemetery.
Wow. That's certainly over-preparedness.
Well,
if my wife was to come to me and say, I want 13 life insurance policies, I certainly my eyebrow would be raised. I mean, you know, it's very excessive, I think the word is, 13 life insurance policies. That's for sure.
I thought so too. Now, some of them were small.
Yeah.
Some of them were through his work. They had that type of thing.
Sure.
But then there were some large ones, like I said, the one that was $250,000 with double indemnity to make it $500,000, and another one for $100,000, another one for $50,000. I mean, there were some pretty large insurance policies out there.
As a reminder, prior to John being shot and killed on the side of the highway, he would in fact be attacked late at night at his home. He would survive this attack, which at the time was passed off as random. However, it would later be discovered that this was anything but random and was the first attempt on John's life. Mark would find out about this attack again from his mother.
Indirectly, she said that someone tried to rob them and John got sort of beat up. It wasn't until after all this happened that the extent of it was revealed. They were in the house one night, and Karen said that she heard a noise in the backyard, and John dutifully grabbed a flashlight and went outside, and when he rounded the corner, there were two hooded people with bats who commenced to beating on him quite vigorously. He tried to make it back to the front door. Karen had locked the door because she said she was afraid. She didn't know what was going on. She was afraid. So John was out there being beat up. The commotion caused some of the neighbors to hear something going on. They turned on the lights, which scared away. They turned the porch lights and stuff, which scared away the assailants. If they hadn't done that, it's very likely he would have been killed. I saw him a month and a half later when he came up for Christmas, and the welts in his face were still pretty predominant. But he didn't want to talk about it.
Right. He didn't want to talk about it at all.
He wrote it off as a rogue attack, that someone was trying to steal things from his shed in the backyard, and they jumped him. They got the better of him.
It's interesting he didn't want to talk about it at all. You know, do you feel that maybe there was some part of him that thought maybe this wasn't a random attack?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I think he was totally 99% sure it was just an attack, a random attack of someone trying to steal things out of their shed.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
In February of 1994, John and Karen Yule were making their way home from a day at the beach when John pulls the car to the side of the road. Karen had said that she thought something might be wrong with it. Once out of the car, Karen would say that a random vehicle pulled up behind them. A man exits the vehicle and shoots John multiple times before driving away. Police would later discover that this is, again, far from a random attack, and in fact had been carried out by John and Karen's house guest, Peter Giffen, or PJ as he was known. Mark talks me through finding out about his brother's death and being informed by detectives that they had suspicions surrounding his brother's new wife. When was the first time you get the call about what had happened to your brother?
As I stated earlier, our family was deployed to Korea, Daegu, yep. Korea. I'm a retired military officer. I got a call early in the morning on our landline, and early morning calls are never good things.
Yeah.
And it was my mother on the other end of the phone. She was very shaken. She had informed me that John had been killed. And the story was, what I could get out of her, was that it was an incident of basically highway robbery or a carjacking gone wrong or something like that. That's all she knew. That's all that I knew. I immediately got a Red Cross message, which is what we do in order to get redeployed, and made my way back across the United States, jumping on different flights and things to make it back in time for the funeral. When I landed at Orlando, not too long after I landed, I was contacted by the lead detective of the case, and he wanted to talk to me. Initially, he wanted to ask me anything I knew about Karen, about their relationship and things like that. And we talked for a little while, and then he sat back and he said, "This just doesn't add up." He said, I don't want to cause any issues, and I don't want to make you feel bad, but the things that we have discovered, that we have found, just don't add up. He asked that I keep an open mind and I keep my eyes open, and we were going to go ahead and go through the funeral and the visitation and everything like that.
That must have been, not only were you having to attend your brother's funeral, but now, you know, detectives told you that this story doesn't add up. So, you know, and you've still got to go through a funeral with everything that comes with that. On top of that, there's going to be a lady there who the police have told you that her story just doesn't make sense.
Right. I mean, it took me almost a day and a half to 2 days to get across the globe and get back to Orlando. And the only thing I knew was that it was a robbery, an attempted robbery on a highway near Orlando. That's all I knew. So when the detective started telling me some of the things that don't add up, it was really eye-opening to me.
When did you find out about Karen's sort of cohort in this whole thing? Was that in that initial discussion with the detective?
They hinted that he may have had a part in it.
Right.
They didn't know the extent. And he took off afterwards. He went back to his hometown. And when it finally came out that he was the trigger man, they had to go get him. I mean, he was not around after the murder.
Yeah, yeah.
Or after the funeral. He was at the funeral.
He was at the funeral?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
The visitation was really interesting because we had a closed family visitation initially, and then it was opened up to the public, to his other friends. So myself, my younger brother, and mother got there at the appropriate time, about a half hour or so before the actual open visitation. And we went up and looked at the body, and I was talking to my mother, making small talk and stuff after we sat down. About 15 minutes after, right before the actual visitation, she came barging in. She was surrounded by a whole bunch of other friends. She was wailing and carrying on, and she went over to the casket and she howled about, "Oh, it's not fair. How could they do this to my husband, yada, yada, yada." And PJ was there too.
yeah.
the trigger man.
Yeah.
And she was there for a while during the actual visitation, and she left early. She didn't know that she was going to be tailed by some detectives. And so after the visitation, she had rented a limousine and she went downtown and partied all night, buying expensive champagne and doing drugs.
Wow. Was PJ with her? Do you know if PJ was with her at this stage?
Yeah, PJ and her whole group of friends and relatives.
This information was news to me, of course. Karen had not offered up much information surrounding the funeral or what she had done after the fact. What shocked me the most was when Mark told me about PJ's role at his brother's funeral.
PJ and I were one of the two pallbearers.
Jesus Christ, that's horrendous.
And I pulled him off to the side after the casket was lowered in and everything sort of breaking up. This was the next day at the actual cemetery. And I saw him, I pulled him aside sort of, and I said, "We're going to get to the bottom of this." I said, we're going to do whatever we possibly can. He didn't know that I had been told that PJ was going to be a suspect.
Yeah.
And I looked at his face and it was just pale. I mean, all the color ran out of his face. He was visibly shaking. And that may have been the reason he took off after the funeral. I am supposing that they did that to not raise any suspicion.
Yeah.
I mean, if he took off right afterwards, they would say, "Well, where did he go? What's the story with him?"
Yeah. True.
An interesting aside to the PJ thing, and right after the murder, is that Karen said when the police came to the crime site that she was pregnant. So they took her by ambulance to the hospital. She had also told PJ that she was pregnant and she was carrying his kid. At the hospital, they were concerned about her being pregnant, so they did some tests. They found out that her tubes had been tied. Also, something that she said in her interview with you was they did not find any gunpowder residue on her hands.
And of course, you know, then they separated John and I. They put me in the back of an ambulance, and they put him in the back of the rescue squad. And then they take us to the nearest hospital. And to this day, I couldn't even tell you which that was, somewhere in Orlando. So they take him there, and then yeah, I guess they pronounce him dead there. And they check me over. And from there, then the detectives come, and they do the GTS on my hands. And they found out that, of course, I did not shoot anything. So it showed that I had no residue on my hand from gunshots of any type. And so they let me go.
When she went to the hospital, she said she had to go to the bathroom. The detectives said, "You can go, but do not wash your hands." She went in the bathroom. She came back out. Her hands were freshly washed. They said, "We told you not to wash your hands." She said, "Oh, I urinated on them. I needed to wash them." So she had, of course, she didn't have any gun residue on her hands because she washed it off.
Karen's whole story was confusing. I think the biggest thing for me with her, with when she was talking about the whole PJ situation and him living there, that the day that the detectives and police come over to talk to her at the house and PJ is still in the house. And I obviously said to her, I said, you know, if you, and she knew then, she said she knew then that he had killed her husband. And I said, well, if you knew, you know, this was the situation and you were scared of PJ, surely with the police in the house with you then and there, you were never going to be more safe than that particular moment right then and there. Did PJ ever get in touch with you or try and contact you in those days?
Yeah, PJ was there within the hour after it happened. He came right back to the house. He was right there with our vehicle.
And were the detectives there as well?
Right up to in the house. Yeah.
So he was in the house with the detectives there.
And my sister.
So,
and he went right to the room, closed the door, and went to bed like nothing happened.
If he was there and the detectives were there, You could have just told the detectives it was him and they would have taken him into custody immediately, and then you would have been safe, essentially.
Yes, I would have been had I been thinking in the right frame of mind, but obviously I was traumatized by the whole event, and I'm listening to my sister and my youngest brother telling me, Karen, just be cool. Let's talk to the attorney. Don't say nothing else.
Obviously, that to me does not make sense, because they say, hey, on the quiet, he did it. You need to get him. They grab him right then. They arrest him. They take him away. Done deal.
She also continually said that PJ was behind it, and PJ did all of it. And in the course of getting ready for the trial, the detectives deposed a lot of people. Three of the people that they deposed stated, each one of them stated in a different way, that Karen had approached them and offered them money for them to kill John. That right there sort of spells it out, that she was the mastermind. They said that she was behind the beating. She arranged the beating. PJ was part of the beating, along with another guy that had been offered money. So that right there sort of really pokes holes in what she has claimed, that PJ was the mastermind and the trigger puller. And there is a possibility that although PJ fired the first shot, which was from the back of his head, under right behind his ear and exiting out the forehead, that was the first shot. And then he fell backwards after that, that he handed the gun, because he was on the other side, he handed the gun over to Karen and she shot the other two shots, one to the heart and one to the middle of the chest, which is why she washed her hands. Why she washed her hands at the hospital.
Did you attend the trial?
I did not. I was unable to get away. I was, again, in Korea, and we were in the middle of some exercise and such. But to the very credit to the Florida corrections system, they did a really good job of allowing myself and my family to influence or to have our say at the trial. I was able to send a two-page document or a two-page letter of my recollections of John and the impact and all those other things. And it was read aloud in court. So I thought that was really, really good. And they also, when she came up for her first interview for possible parole after the 25 years, they informed me of that again. And they allowed me to again submit something to be read to the interviewer or to the board, stating our point of view.
You know, last time Karen and I spoke, and it's been quite a while now, but the last time we spoke, she was hoping for the potential of a release at some stage. Have you heard any, have they contacted you at any stage in recent times regarding her potential release?
I was contacted immediately after the board turned down her request. And again, I tried to explain it to in an email. They have an interview and what they call a pre-presumptive parole before they go through actual parole. Mm-hmm. She hasn't been put up for parole. They have to go through an interview process, gathering information, gathering her conduct in prison and things like that, in order to put things together to see if she is even ready to go to the parole board before pleading the case. So that happened at the 25-year mark, mm-hmm. because life for this particular case, since both the first-degree murder and the attempted first-degree murder, in other words, the baseball bat incident and the actual shooting, were served concurrently.
Yep.
So at 25 years, she requested and was granted this interview option, this interview process. I was contacted to present a victim's statement if I wanted to. We did. I did it on behalf of the family. My brother and I put it together. And not long after that board met, I was informed that the board had denied her application for this thing to move forward. And normally, if you're denied, you have 2 years to do it again. But the board felt that her crimes were so over the top that they pushed that out to the maximum, which is 7 years. So her next opportunity is July of 2025. Her actual release date is August of 2081. And she'll be around 117 years old.
You know, obviously losing anyone in a family has an effect on the family, of course. But losing someone in the way in which your family lost someone is even worse still. You know, how did it affect your family as a whole, losing your brother?
It really hit my mother very hard, obviously because she was a widow.
Mm.
She had already lost her husband, my father, and now she had to lose her middle son. In about, I don't know how many states away it is from Wisconsin, but it's a long ways away. So it devastated her, and she never got closure. She passed 3 years ago. We never got closure because she never contacted the family. She never expressed remorse. She didn't really do anything for any of us. There was only one time that she contacted my mother. That was 2 days after the funeral. She wanted to start getting the insurance money. She wanted my mother to give the other two insurance policies that had her on there. She wanted those also. So that's the only contact we had. Behind bars, she has claimed that she has turned over, that she's now a born-again Christian, that she's been saved, and all those other things.
Yeah.
We are also Christians, and we believe in forgiveness, but we also believe in showing contrition or remorse. She's never shown that. She's got all these letters and things saying how great of a in-prison ministry, or she's been parts of in-prison ministries, but she never reached out to us. She never said, I'm sorry. I'm sorry for your loss. Nothing. Which girds us even more when we get contacted and have the opportunity to have a victim's statement. If there was a possibility that she had remorse, that she gave an explanation about why she did it and realized that John was a living person and not just a means to an end, we might have a better understanding of the situation. But right now we don't. We don't have that closure. My mother didn't have that closure, and I don't think the rest of the family is going to get that closure.
If she was to reach out to you and say she wanted to talk to you, would you be open to having a conversation with her? Or, you know, unless it was about her calling to do those things, to apologize, to explain the situation?
I would welcome contact. I don't know how it would be received. She keeps clinging to this story that PJ did it all and she was just an innocent bystander. The evidence that I have proves otherwise.
Well, look, I can't thank you enough for reaching out to me again in, you know, in such a nice way. And, you know, you did say some nice things about the way in which I conducted the chats with Karen, which I appreciate, you know, because I do, you know, I think a lot of people, you know, the people that don't like what we do, I think a lot of them don't think I think of victims, and I don't think of, you know, that there is people out there that have suffered at the hands of certain people that we may speak with. And I certainly do, and I'm always very careful about that and do think that through.
We were very impressed and appreciative of the due diligence that you put in.
And that means a lot to me for you to say that. So thank you very much indeed.
And I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you and to let you know that John was a real person and she treated him like a piece of toilet paper. He was a means to an end, and when it was done, she threw him away.
Mark did say to me that he would most certainly be open to a conversation with Karen. He and his family are still looking for some form of closure with his brother's death. I offered to Mark to reach out to Karen on his behalf and let her know that we'd had this conversation and see whether she would be willing to speak with him. Of course, I told Mark that I'm not sure that he would get what he's looking for from Karen, but nonetheless, I would ask, which I did. And Karen responded to me. She said that she would definitely be happy to speak with Mark, and I quote, give him the closure he needs. This, I believe, should be a private conversation between Karen and Mark and will not be aired on 1 minute Remaining for public consumption. However, should Mark wish to share the results of that conversation with me, then I will pass them on to you. 1 Minute Remaining is a Mashed Pumpkin production, created, hosted, and produced by Jack Lawrence. Audio and sound design by Jack Lawrence and Dom Evans of Earsay.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.